Welcome to the Commentary Magazine podcast. Today is Monday, January 27th, 2020. I am John Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary. With me, as always, senior editor Abe Greenwald. Hello, Abe.
Hi, John.
Associate editor Noah Rothman. Hi, Noah.
Hi, John.
And in Washington, senior writer Christine Rosen. Hi, Christine.
Hi, John.
So our friend John Bolton, longtime Commentary contributor, well known to be in the works with a book. Finally, contents of the book leaked to the New York Times last night, Sunday night, revealing what I think everybody who is, you know, serious and I would say honest has already come to acknowledge or believe, which is that Donald Trump withheld aid from Ukraine in order to force the Ukrainian government to investigate the Bidens. This is important in two ways. One, this is the first direct discussion, we haven't seen it, but in theory, where Trump himself says something to the person who is delivering the narrative. That it is Trump who says, we're withholding the aid. It's not that, you know, it came through penumbras and emanations or hints or whatever. So this is a direct tie from someone close to him. And apparently a couple of other things, like it reveals that if the accounts are correct, that Mick Mulvaney lied in some fashion or other.
Was present in one of the meetings where he said he had always removed himself, meetings with Giuliani, where he'd always removed himself to preserve attorney-client privilege, and also that Attorney General Barr was aware of this before he had said it. That's an outright misstatement. Of course, if John Bolton's recollections are correct, then he outright misstated when he was made aware of
this. Well, in both of those cases, though, with the Mulvaney case and the Barr case, correct me if I'm wrong, because I'm now, you know, this is what I read late last night. These are not things that either of them said directly. These are things that were said by spokesmen. Certainly in the Barr case, it was said by a spokesman that Barr had no recollection or Barr hadn't participated in, hadn't known about something. It's not that Barr said it. And I think that's true of Mulvaney, but, you know, if I'm wrong, I'm wrong. I was, by the way, wrong on the last podcast when I said that Tom Steyer was at 15% in one poll. He's at 15% in South Carolina in one poll, so I need to correct that that misstatement. Anyway.
Lastly, about the Bolton revelations, is that his understanding is the president wanted to continue that hold indefinitely until he received some confirmation from Ukraine that these investigations were forthcoming.
Right. Okay. So the exculpatory, again, since we haven't seen the manuscript and we don't know who's leaked it and for what purpose, and it's all very confusing whether somehow it got out because of people hostile to Trump inside the administration, or whether this is an effort to do a news dump because it was going to come out anyway by the Trump people themselves. I mean, we don't know.
Well, why? Why would it?
Why would it come out?
Yeah. This is under the review process. Presuming it's never leaked, White House can, within its rights, strike these passages and the book would have been published.
We don't know.
I mean, this is part of one of my frustrations, is they're trying to frame Bolton's behavior as completely inconsistent and just seeking money, trying to promote his book.
Well, that's not they. That's Sean Davis, or, you know, there are a couple of people on Twitter.
Like, no. The left. The left is making this claim that he has to come out and testify, and he's only withholding because he wants to. You know, his behavior has been completely consistent. He was waiting for the courts to rule on this, and when the Democrats withdrew and the courts mooted it, he said, I wanted to come out and talk, and now he wrote this down in the book, which probably forces his hand, but it was in the White House review process. Presumably, there's a universe in which we never know any of this.
Okay, the White House cannot. I mean, the review process does not give the administration carte blanche to say that must be struck. That is not the way clearance works. The review process itself can be taken to court. This is not something that, you know, they just don't have the right to edit the manuscript. So theoretically, these cases of privilege would come out, and I think, generally speaking, if that were the case, because it was being adjudicated in court, probably the manuscript would leak anyway, somehow, because there would be enough of it around. And it is obviously sitting somewhere around Simon and Schuster. I mean, there apparently no one else has read it, really. We don't know. The whole thing doesn't matter.
Well, then there's a theory in which this does the White House a favor by coming out now and not October.
That's what I just read. Yeah. Well, it was in March.
This is why the Republican senators are now so angry at the White House, right? They're claiming that some are, and saying, you know, they should have at least given us a heads up that they knew that this was out there. So you think that that's not true? I mean, the Times is reporting.
Who knows?
That
like
angry.
You can't tell. Hmm. Honestly, in these first 12-hour things, it's like a game of telephone. Like somebody says, Republican senators must be mad, and then by the third iteration, it's Republican senators are mad. You know, like you don't know whether Republican senators. The story came out at 11 o'clock last night. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, or something.
Earlier than that, I was asleep by 11.
Okay, so 9. I mean, it wasn't early. It wasn't. You know, it's not like they're you know, they're sitting around. Anyway, it doesn't matter how it came out. Where you're right, Noah, is Bolton said, "I will testify if I am subpoenaed." Right? He was not subpoenaed by the House. For some reason, they did not subpoena him because they thought they would use this other
subpoena.
Right.
And then they withdrew that subpoena in November.
Right.
And then the court mooted the case when articles passed.
Right. Okay. So, but
the court
he
didn't
said,
even listen to Democrats when they withdrew the subpoena. It just kept litigating the case.
Right.
Which is weird.
So he said, if you subpoena me, I'll testify. And then, theoretically, the administration would assert executive privilege, and then they would have to adjudicate whether or not he could testify. Now, executive privilege is an interesting construct at this point in any form of testimony, because the general way that executive privilege is dealt with is not simply to say so-and-so cannot testify because of executive privilege. It is that the information that he has can be, literally a lawyer can say he cannot answer that question because that is privileged. And then in theory, that question and its answer can then go to a court, which can then conceivably order the question answered, which could take, you know, months or something. So the Trump administration asserted its right to not have its people testify who were not confirmed officials who work for the executive office of the president on the grounds that this is a separation of powers issue, not an executive privilege issue. Everybody's merging these things together. That Congress does not have the right to compel testimony from people who work directly for the president. They work for the president, and the president is co-equal with the legislature, and it does not have call upon them. Generally speaking, that confrontation hasn't gone all the way. Like, generally speaking, something is negotiated so that you don't have a huge crisis. But the fast-tracking of the impeachment process meant that since the House decided it wanted to get this impeachment done, you know, by the beginning of December or whenever it was, the middle of December, obviously I don't think they were ever going to have a negotiation where something was going to get agreed to properly between the executive and the legislative there. But there could have been court decisions and things like that. Bolton is doing nothing wrong. This notion that he would, you know, he could just give an interview and tell people what he said before he wrote his book. He wrote a book that is now being vetted. But as I say, it's not that the White House has a sort of prima facie way of saying you're not allowed to say anything. The CIA has that right with certain kinds of things that are written for the CIA or for the State Department, because that can place Americans or foreign sources or something in jeopardy and, like, literally, you know, like, put people's lives at stake. But this is a complicated matter, is all I'm saying. I hope this isn't, like, insanely boring, because now we're just talking process and we should now talk about what the actual political fallout is. So, Abe.
Well, you know, I was just thinking, you know, in when I was reading about it, something that struck me that's been a consistent feature of the Trump administration's and his problems along these lines. Because one of the things that is supposedly revealed by Bolton is that both he and Mike Pompeo spoke to Trump about this, warning both.
And Mike Esper, the Secretary of Defense.
That's right, and Esper, right, warning him not to do this. And if you think back to, so the big proponents for the Ukraine interference conspiracy theory were all these sort of like, this goes back to like Mike Flynn, Paul Manafort, and Rudy Giuliani. They sort of put this initial paranoid idea out there. And then it is the establishment Republicans who try to warn against this stuff, who sort of try to, you know, say this is going to get you in trouble, this is bad. And then it inevitably, when it hits the fan, it falls again on the establishment Republicans to sort of get them out of it, to sort of show a brave face, to tamp down on the to do damage control, and then the hardcore sort of Trumpians are somehow end up mad at them.
You're mad at them because they haven't seen through the conspiratorial play that they were
exactly
advocating,
right.
Which would have worked. But for the interference of those weak-kneed establishmentarian Republicans.
I mean, and this happens, too, on the question of the obstruction of justice in the Mueller report, too, right? He was being saved unwittingly every step, the president was, every step of the way, not by those who said, we're just going to sort of ignore that request. We're not going to do what the president is asking us to do here.
Right, yeah, which is what the testimony of Don McGahn, the White House counsel, that was the other subject of litigation in terms of a subpoena before the House, was supposed to detail, right? The Mueller report has McGahn ignoring the president's requests to do things, right? And so the idea was, could you get McGahn to testify? So what we have here in the Bolton, as I said, the key thing about the Bolton testimony is that it's Trump himself directly saying, withhold the aid. That is the linchpin that has been missing here. Not that you couldn't, you know, presume it, because nothing made sense without it. It's somebody saying it to someone rather than simply intuiting it. But, you know, if you were trying to make a case that wasn't entirely circumstantial, you had to have somebody directly saying that Trump issued this directive. So that is what the Bolton information does.
Well, OMB had emails from people saying that this came from POTUS, which presumably came from Mick Mulvaney, who presumably heard it from the president.
But then you would need, as I think we've been saying on this podcast for 4 months, you would need Mulvaney directly saying, Trump told me, or Bolton saying, Trump told me, and apparently the manuscript says, Trump told me. So you have that direct connection.
Okay, but this, I think we're forgetting that just after midnight early today, Trump himself tweeted out, you know, one of his all caps, I never told John Bolton that the aid to Ukraine was tied to investigations into Democrats. So the Trump folks are already setting this up as a he said, right? And you know, as much as truth is, you know, part-time mistress for Trump, I think that the political ramifications are to try to smear Bolton, make him seem like he's, you know, just money-grubbing to get his book sales up.
And a disgruntled,
exactly,
fired employee.
And he keeps saying, oh, he never said this at his very public termination. I mean, the kind of rhetoric ramp-up that Trump is doing right now, I think, is strategic in the sense that it will resonate with the people who want to believe that there's no there. But we've also mentioned before on the podcast that, you know, Bolton is going to tell the truth, but there's also this question of executive privilege and whether or not he does believe in a powerful executive. So it's not necessarily clear that, you know, Bolton, if called to be a witness, is going to be the Whitaker Chambers of this entire impeachment thing. I mean, I don't think the Democrats have necessarily thought through just how rogue an element Bolton might be for their side as well.
I suspect that they're more nervous about that than they just came up with this strategy of more witnesses simply as a means of prolonging the pain, or whatever, creating a greater degree of uncertainty about Trump's guilt or innocence, because they know that he's going to get acquitted also. So the question then is, what's in it for them to keep this going with witnesses, unless it's simply just the logic that led them to impeach in the first place? If you pull back and don't take the sort of, you know, babbity, you know, self-congratulatory, this had to be done because, you know, else otherwise the Republic will crash and fall, right? If it's not that, then you have to say, so what is their game? Like, why do they want to have it go on more than a couple of weeks?
Well, I don't know, but you can posit a theory in which Republicans get a healthy share of the blame when more details come out in October about this thing that they chose not to litigate. Look, Trump also said he didn't know Lev Parnas. And then over the weekend, we had a recording drop of him talking about the getting rid of Marie Yovanovitch, right, which he didn't do, by the way. They decided to smear her instead of just fire her.
No, and then they fired her.
And then, well, yeah, after the character assassinated her and had people apparently threaten to follow her around and just make her life a living hell before they actually remove her.
Yeah, but they character assassinated. Yeah.
But bottom line, it didn't matter because he was representing his personal, the president's personal attorney was representing these clients, and Marie Yovanovitch was a problem for them. And people are recording the president because they don't trust him.
Right.
The people around the president are keeping copious notes and recording him surreptitiously because they're afraid of what he's going to say about them later.
By the way, you know,
what else do Republicans have to worry about that hasn't come out yet?
This raises another question, which is, you know, are we now going to get to the point where people are going to walk into the Oval Office and it's going to be like when people go to concerts now, where they're going to put their phones, they're going to put their devices in a bag and close the bag up so that, I mean, people should not be surreptitiously taping the President of the United States. Like, this is also like the president, you know, is on his personal cell phone at Mar-a-Lago. And, you know, don't think that the Chinese don't know literally everything that comes out of his mouth. They know everything that comes out of his mouth. So something's going to have to be done about this once, you know, this particularly incautious person is no longer president, because, you know, I mean, talk about the compromises here. Lev Parnas is taping the president at private meetings on his iPhone. He's taping him on his iPhone. Like, you know, it sort of beggars belief. Anyway, but I would, so if we pull this out of the whole process thing, so as I say, so Bolton now establishes this. Does it matter? I mean, in other words, we've been presuming for weeks that Trump ordered a halt, a cessation of the aid, because he wanted these either the announcement of the investigations or the investigations. The question of his state of mind is, did he want them because he remains consumed by the weird injustice of the election that he won and seems to need to prove that he was, you know, they were trying to rig it against him and he won it anyway and he wants more evidence that they did this by finding the server in Ukraine where there was no server? Or was he doing this because he was looking to game 2020?
Nobody is making the either-or argument.
Okay,
Okay,
but I can make an either-or argument here, which is that the way that the Times phrased Bolton's characterization, and the Times has not seen the manuscript, it was only described to them, according to the Times. What Bolton said, he wanted to know what went on in 2016. It matters whether he is consumed with CrowdStrike because he wants to know, you know, just how deep the conspiracy against him went in 2016, or whether this was a plan to, you know.
I got to say, that's very strange. Half a dozen witnesses have said and. The transcript says,
but they didn't talk to him.
The transcript of the president mentions both things in the same breath.
Yeah, but when he says Biden's and CrowdStrike and Biden's and CrowdStrike, that doesn't mean that he's interested in Biden for 2020. That goes to state of mind anyway.
I actually think that because the way he the way the president spoke about it in that call. in this kind of stream of consciousness way, I think that is emblematic of his thinking on this, which is that it is all this jumble, that this, there's this tangled conspiracy that worked against him, and that if you dig more in Ukraine, perhaps you'll find that Biden's involved in it somehow, and that it is all connected. I mean, it's not a defense.
No, it's hardly exculpatory. Right, right. It's even worse, actually. I mean, the notion,
it's
the vagueness of the 2020 notion that he's trying to tar the Bidens, I guess his supporters think it's a little more exculpatory, that it's retrospective into 2016, but that conspiracy theory is 25th Amendment territory. It's crazy.
The impeachment charges, as Schiff said, go to the question of whether he was abusing power in order to cheat in the 2020 election. That is the charge that they are attempting to remove him from office on. It's not about 2016.
So his supporters can say, no, it's not just about 2020. It's only about this absolutely unmoored conspiracy theory that the president is infatuated with.
Yes.
Okay, that's the
Well, you can laugh all you like, but the 25th Amendment isn't invoked like by you know, just anybody. It has to be invoked by a majority of his cabinet.
He's not going to be removed from office either. That doesn't mean he shouldn't be.
I'm not talking. That's okay, so let's go to that question, okay? Bolton says Trump ordered the cessation of the aid. What we know is the aid was ceased, kind of, but when they got wind of the whistleblower and the fact that Congress was on to them, the aid cessation was suspended, right? The suspension was suspended in September when it was inaugurated in July. So effectively, the implicit Machiavellian, like, not getting into either defenses or attacks or whatever, is that in the larger picture, it was no harm, no foul. Maybe he wanted to suspend the aid ended up not being suspended for whatever reason, and whatever reason he did it, and it was bad or it was whatever, okay? So I don't think that line, which I think is what the Republican senators think in their own heads, even if they're not going to say it, if they're, you know, not just, you know, serving as blocking tackles, that's where they would go, which is, look, the aid wasn't suspended anyway. You expect us to remove him from office for aid that wasn't suspended? And I would say, again, not that that is anything that is being said, because it's not being said. Although when people say, as Senator Brown of Indiana said on Meet the Press this week, I hope Trump will learn from this process to, you know, like, be better. I mean, he sort of said that.
Be best, John.
Be best, sorry, right? Okay. That I think that still holds, right? What I'm saying, which is, in the end, nothing bad happened. Sort of like the second part of the Mueller report, which is, he wanted to obstruct justice, but it didn't happen. It didn't happen really because no one did what he told them to. Right. If they had done what he told them to, then justice would have been obstructed. And so, no harm, no foul.
Except in the telling. I mean, the argument is that by telling people to obstruct justice, he was willingly, you know, undermining the oath of office that he took as president.
And in the context of international relations, there is a whole universe of implication around the president weaponizing foreign policy that does have ramifications beyond the political.
No one denies that all of this has ramifications. The question is whether the ramifications rise to, again, in a universe in which we didn't already know what the foregone conclusion here, whether they rise to the level of he should be removed from office. The only president in American history to be actively removed from office.
That's great terrain for Republicans to be fighting on if the president would allow them to fight on it. He will not. He maintains nothing happened.
Well, maybe that's what he lost. Let's go to that. Maybe the Bolton thing denies him, it's the moment at which he is rocked on his heels defensively, and it denies him the House behavior, okay? The House of Representatives behavior, which is he didn't do it. And if he did it, it was totally legal because he can fire an ambassador and he can suspend aid for, you know, because he is worried about corruption and he can do whatever he wants, but he didn't, but he could if he wanted to. And you're just liberals and you stink and all of that. Right.
But doesn't it only deny him the he didn't do it part?
Well, that's what I'm saying. Yeah, I'm saying now he may not have this. He may not have the suasion over the Republican senators. They may find it in their own heads necessary to say, look, we are not happy with what went on here.
I feel like they were there when this first started. Well,
but we don't know because...
And then they pulled back to the...
There are 53 of them. So how do we know what they all thought? We don't know what they all thought. But I'm just saying, and you know, Mitch McConnell is like, I'm just going to get through this because, you know, I've just been handed this crap sandwich and I'm going to try to dispose of it as quickly as possible because we're not removing him from office. So the question is, how do we not remove him from office in the way that does us the least damage and maybe does them a little harm? Which is why he's now the most hated person, you know, in the universe and, you know, and is being consigned to hell on Saturday Night Live.
Did you see much of the highlights from the testimony on Saturday?
No, I didn't see any of the testimony on Saturday as I was at a bat mitzvah. So
yeah, so apparently it was very quick. It was close to what you had anticipated, which was that the defense, as it were, I guess it's defense, yeah, would essentially say prosecution hasn't proved his case. That's the end of that. And they did sort of cater to that sentiment by saying, we're going to be very brief, respect your time. You've been through too much of this already. We'll be done by 1 o'clock at absolute latest. I went a little later than that, but not much. But it was all, you know, effrontery and high dudgeon. And you had Pat Cipollone say this line, which
that's the White House counsel.
They've come here today and they basically said, let's cancel the election over a meeting with Ukraine. With the Ukraine. They keep saying the Ukraine. That's irresponsible.
That's
absolutely no reason. That's
a Soviet formulation.
It would be a completely irresponsible abuse of power to do what they're doing, what they're asking you to do, to stop an election, to interfere in the election, and to remove the president of the United States from the ballot. The cancel the election meeting is really close to Adam Schiff saying, you know, we can't have another election. We can't be trusted with another election because he might cheat again, or it might cheat. Whether or not he used again is debatable. But this one, you know, generated absolutely no consternation from the
usual suspects. It's not debatable that he said it.
No, and not in that particular moment.
No,
he said it previously.
He said it
on the Senate floor.
He didn't say it on the Senate floor.
But yeah, just saying they're trying to cancel the election is absolute nonsense. And you would imagine that people who have some consistency, or at least aspire to consistency, would be as frustrated with Mr. Cipollone as they were with Mr. Schiff.
Oh, come on. I mean, I'm sorry, but the line that Democrats have been, you know, Democrats have been looking to impeach Trump since November 9th, 2016.
So
well, I mean, that goes to intent, like, you know.
The intent of the prosecution?
Yes.
Okay. Well, the facts of this particular case are in evidence, and people who want to, you know, ruminate on those facts can, and those who don't might go into ancient history.
Okay, but then I think it's worth asking this question, which is, presume that the worst that you can think is true, which is Trump would have kept the hold on forever if it hadn't been discovered, that the hold was solely an effort to, you know, get the rival that he wanted for the 2020 election, who was Bernie Sanders, and to kill off Biden, and that, you know, he, you know, abused an ambassador and he did terrible things here and he did.
This is the president's defense.
No, I'm saying, imagine that this is all of this is the case. Should he be removed from office over a $300 million aid cessation?
Weighty thing, and I am discomforted by the gravity of that. I think everybody should be, but you can't really have a full discussion on that once you're still arguing on the merits of
the
argument.
We can. I'm saying,
well, it's not up to us.
Well, it certainly isn't up to us. I think the problem here is that as I have come to, like, consider this over time, and as somebody who, you know, is known as not a particular supporter, you know, of the president or whatever, I gotta go with, it's not enough to throw him out of office.
But it's also not so trifling that I don't think it would hit me as a great miscarriage of justice if he did.
I think that's a very good way of putting it, that it is not, it's terrible. It's a terrible thing that happened, and that to the extent that the election in 2020 will have to cope with the consequences of this thing that he did. Nobody else did it. He did it. Is justified. I mean, that is justified. But Adam Schiff's argument that he should be removed from office because this proves that he will in some fashion or other try to cheat to win is a bizarre pre-crime argument. You know, you don't convict somebody of a crime based on the possibility that he'll commit a crime you can't imagine down the road.
Okay, but I don't actually think that if Biden is the nominee, I think you're right that Trump will be answering for all of the Ukraine stuff for a while. But if Bernie Sanders is the nominee, nobody's going to be talking about Ukraine. They're going to be talking about socialism. I honestly think that is going to be in terms of the political fallout for the election. If Trump is not removed and Biden is the nominee, yes, this will continue. But if it's Sanders, that completely changes things. And look, Sanders is ahead of New Hampshire. There's this supposed surge. He is the ideal candidate for Trump to go up against.
Okay,
and the Democrats might thwart their own momentum here themselves without needing, you know, to remove a president to get there.
Okay, well, here's my then diabolical form, you know, conception here, which is, what if the Sanders surge has something to do with Democrats being discomfited by the news about Hunter Biden and Burisma? What if Bernie Sanders' message, which is essentially that he is the insurgent and that if you go with Biden, you're going with another version of Hillary, the swamp, corrupt family, double, you know, self-dealing and all of that. Not that anyone is saying this, but that it actually has had some positive impact on Bernie's message. Because it's not like Bernie's message has changed. And it's also not like when you look at how the surge numbers go, you think, okay, well, obviously Warren is collapsing, so Bernie is gaining. But these polls, Bernie is gaining without the Warren collapse. I mean, he isn't gaining. No, but it's not at one for one. Like, he doesn't go up 7 points and she goes down 7 points. She's down and he's now accreting upward, according to this stuff. So something else is happening.
In the New York Times, Siena, which had a Bernie surge, Nate Cohen, who is a New York Times writer, has all these numbers, is saying essentially that it's not as though Joe Biden doesn't have support. It's just that his support was not committed to caucus for him.
Right. In other words,
he has plenty of support to win the caucuses.
But he also has huge support with 2018 voters, people who voted in 2018, and primary voters. But caucus voters in Iowa and a couple of the other places like Nevada, which is also a caucus state, are less likely to vote for him, which strikes me as weird, and I don't really understand
It's all about energy anyway.
Okay, but you know, I know it's harder to go to a caucus that if Democrats are enlivened to vote because they want Trump to lose, and they'll go to a caucus. Like, I don't know. People stand online for 3 hours to vote on election day. You know, a caucus takes about 3 hours. I don't know. The thing about the polling is, and I checked with some people I trust, is that these polls appear to be polling based on different assumptions. So you have polls where Biden is up in Iowa, polls where Sanders is up in Iowa simultaneously, and there are national polls with Biden way ahead and Sanders really close or whatever. And some of this is how you count younger voters. Like, a lot of this is whether or not you think that there's going to be a surge in younger voters at the caucuses in Iowa, in which case Bernie will win easily. That has never materialized before. Like, that doesn't really happen. Happened a little bit with Obama, but it's still the case that 18 to 21 year old people do not go out and either vote or caucus.
That's why Sanders keeps trotting out AOC, though, at all these rallies, I think.
Right. But this is the question is, are we going to see something new? Are they picking up the fact that younger people are going to do this? And that if you poll more conventionally, Biden looks stronger than he is? Or are they, is this illusory? Like, maybe it's an illusion. Maybe Sanders isn't going to perform as well as the Iowa, New Hampshire poll new ones say, because they're overestimating, they're overweighting.
When you look at voters. I don't have any real special insight into any of this, but when you look at the actual results in Iowa over the course of this century, the polling is always a lot tighter than the actual results. Somebody breaks out the lowered polling folks, obviously, because you're caucusing and they winnow support from the lower tier that they eventually move on and they're in the low single digits. All the people who are getting 8-9% now in the polls
will
be around like 2.
Right. Well, particularly after the first, so, you know, the way caucuses work, people now know much more about this than they used to, but the way caucuses work is that there are a series of votes, and so if your choice, if you have 5 or 6 people who, you know, get divide up like 20% of the vote or something like that, their voters are asked on the second ballot to go for somebody else.
So I'm saying it's easy to envision a scenario in which Bernie Sanders wins by 32-33,
right?
Or Joe Biden wins by 32-33, even though none of them are polling even,
They're within a point of
Hillary Clinton won Iowa by 0.3 of a point.
Right. And Cruz
won
Iowa
by like 5 points.
By 5 points, but of course, his father killed JFK, and they lied about Carson getting out of the race and
grave
whatever.
Injustice.
I think the Sanders surge is real, or at least more real than not.
You want to believe it's real because you've been waiting for it.
Yeah.
Of course it's real. I'm just saying you've been waiting for this for a year.
I have.
Finally getting it.
This is true, but.
Marianne, give him Bernie.
in the course of this year that I've been waiting for this, Biden has been unimpressive, bumbling, sort of fence-sitting, ultimately uninspiring in a very otherwise colorful field. How long can that go on without... And I think things like the Hunter stuff and the Burisma tie-in, that all plays into it. But... You know, how many debates, how many performances can we say, well, no one really, he wasn't great, but he didn't really hurt himself that much. I mean, that accretes over time, and that's not a great ultimate campaign.
We can say, I think everybody here is in agreement, that it's pretty much a two-man race now, that all the press's efforts to make Elizabeth Warren happen have failed.
Right.
That she even won the Des Moines Register endorsement over the weekend, and she's probably going to place. She may not even get a delegate.
Yeah, Buttigieg, pretty much the same. That Buttigieg, again, once people get into the question of, are you going to let Bernie Sanders be the nominee, or are you going to let Biden be the nominee, are going to have to make a choice, and ultimately, it is a two-man. I mean, it will be a two-man race unless, one or the other of these 98-year-old people, has a coronary.
Even if Buttigieg pulled in a behind, come from behind victory and narrow victory, which seems like the most plausible pathway to victory at this point for him, if there is one, that it wouldn't translate to the rest of the country's primaries.
The one reason to be pessimistic, let's say, if you're a supporter of Biden, about Biden's chances in Iowa is that Iowa is really about organizing. I mean, it's really about having, people who put 8 people in a car and drive to the caucus site. I mean, it matters. Every single person who is brought to one of those giant rooms to stand up and be counted. And Buttigieg and Warren apparently have the best organizations in Iowa. That's why you can't count them out in some fashion. If they, if they really pull it off, you could have a surprising result. Now, how that leverages into New Hampshire, which is a primary state, and you know, where people can, of course, also Republicans can do a lot of damage, because you can cross over, you can vote, I believe you can cross over vote in New Hampshire, and they could, you know, you could have Republican, you could have 50,000 Republicans voting for Bernie Sanders to try to get him to win over Biden. You know, I don't know. I mean, that's the famous, what was it, Operation Chaos, somebody called it in 2016?
Rush Limbaugh.
Right. But it's a real thing.
2008.
You know. Was it 2008?
That's how old
okay.
we were, yeah.
Oh, my God. Oh, so old.
But that was an effort to get Barack Obama to a poll position over Hillary Clinton, prolong the primaries, which was successful. Those primaries prolonged for a very long time.
Prolonged for a long time.
Congratulations.
Really, yeah, that was 70 million votes. 70 million votes later. So the other part of the national polling that is interesting and that gets everybody's head spun is that on the one hand, every poll shows half the country supporting the removal of Donald Trump as president. So right there, you would say he is screwed. Like he's not going to win in November. If half the country wants him to be removed from office, like that's a pretty extreme thing to want him removed from office. Like 33% of people wanted Bill Clinton removed from office. So that's pretty high. On the other hand, he is at his highest watermark in both Gallup and ABC Washington Post in the course of his presidency. You have a very interesting number in the ABC Washington Post poll, which is I think 59 or 60% of people say they're not worried about their futures economically, which is the first time that number has been over 50% in, I don't know, 15 years or something like that. So I don't know what the overall averages are, but there is optimistic news for Trump in national polling. That is belied by the like strength of the support for removal. Like if he's at 50% for removal, but 46% of people say, and also I think 49% of Americans think he's going to win in November. So 50% of them want him to be removed. Now maybe that makes sense because you want him removed because you think he's going to win. So you got to get him out through some other modality. I don't know. Christine, do you have any
I go back to my the point about Sanders. I just think that everything shifts if Sanders surges, and actually the surge propels him to the nomination. And let's remember, he wasn't actually, you know, when he was going up against Hillary Clinton in the primaries before, she didn't really pummel him as she could. But there's so many ways in which you can imagine a Trump campaign just going to town on Bernie. I mean, it's just, you know, I mean, the guy was on unemployment when he was in his 30s. You know, he honeymooned in Moscow. I mean, the list goes on and on. He proudly calls himself a socialist when the overwhelming majority of Americans, according to polling, say they will not ever support a socialist as president.
I'm sorry, I briefly, just to underscore your point, Christine, there's one of the values of being on Twitter, and there are few, increasingly few, but one of them is to watch the conventional wisdom form in real time. And over late last week, there was sort of this thing that dawned on reporters collectively that Bernie Sanders had never really been vetted. He's been in the Senate for decades. He ran for president in 2016. He damn near got the nomination. But he's never really been vetted because, like, there were statements coming out.
Who's vetted him? We vetted him.
Right.
The right has vetted him.
I just saw a video the other day of him, like, heaping praise on Daniel Ortega in the 1980s. Mm-hmm. It's like, why? Never seen that. Never heard anything about it.
This is the eerie parallel to the British example with Corbyn, which is that the people who knew about Corbyn and had the goods on Corbyn and studied Corbyn and went back and looked at Corbyn and all of that were the conservative journalists in Britain. Whereas the liberal were, on the one hand, dismissive because he was a backbencher, you know, like flake. And then, on the other hand, defensive because they didn't want to do the conservatives' dirty work for them. So we know vastly more about Sanders than liberal journalists do. I would prefer to know as little about Bernie Sanders as possible. Like, you know, I already had my I had my day of interesting obsession with the America, the history of the American Communist Party, and I knew a lot about where they organized and this and that and the other thing, and the post-communists and the socialists. And I've now forgotten a lot of it, and now I'm like, it's all coming back to me like a horrible, you know, nightmare that I can remember, you know, what Stalinist hiring hall was at 2165 Stony Island Avenue in South Stony Island in, you know, in Chicago. Like, I don't need to remember these details.
But Christine, and, I'm sorry, could you go?
Oh, I was just going to say, also, weirdly, I know this might not resonate with those of us who are more conservative sensibilities, but there's a way in which Bernie's message, especially when heard by younger voters, actually seems optimistic, right? Because he wants to double the size of the federal government and tax the hell out of the wealthy, but he wants to do it in the service of a vision of a better world, right? So there's a weird kind of, it's like a mirror image of Reagan's optimism, but in socialist form with Bernie, that is appealing to them. I mean, they like to hear it. It's why AOC is drawing crowds with Bernie, talking to young people about his message, and putting that up against Trump, who's, you know, fairly nihilistic, at least if you read his Twitter feed, it's a real challenge to make America great again, right? It's more future oriented. It's sort of denouncing past corruption and looking ahead. So I can see the appeal, and I don't think that appeal has waned, especially if you look at his grassroots support.
It's not just rhetorical either. There's an argument that Democrats make, which I think is resonant for particularly not just swing voters, but conservative-oriented suburban women voters. And it resonates with me, which is that there is a moral argument against this presidency and that you have to compromise values in order to support the results, which a lot of Republicans like and a lot of Americans like. And that's a strong argument, but it goes right out the window when the other guy is an unrepentant communist Soviet apologist. There is no moral argument against supporting that.
Right. Well, there is a moral argument. The other thing to be said in your formulation, Christine, is that like Trump, Sanders, and like, you know, winners in the past, this is a very big message that doesn't have a lot of the details filled in.
Right.
So it's, you know, we're gonna save America by throwing billionaires in jail, and, you know, we're gonna have all this wonderful candy is gonna rain down on us. But I'm not putting flesh on it. Like, you know, somebody, Margaret Brennan on Face the Nation said to him, how much is your plan going to cost? And he said, well, we don't know. We don't know how much it's going to cost. And he's like, well, how can you go to the American people and not say what's going to cost? And he's like, he basically is like, I'm not getting into that briar patch. You want me? I'm going to do this. Not that he can pull it off, like, you know, socialized healthcare, like by snapping his fingers. I don't know how much it's going to cost, and I'm not going to give you the talking point against me by saying it's $50 trillion, because I already saw Elizabeth Warren drive herself into a brick wall by answering these questions. So what did Elizabeth Warren do? She was the same thing. I'm going to give you all candy. And then, like an idiot, she then made policy papers out of it.
Oh, wait. I mean, it's not as though these details are unknown to reporters. Bernie Sanders' Medicare for All bill was scored. The Mercatus Center Urban Institute scored it. The only reason why we know these plans cost $30 trillion is because the Bernie bill was scored.
I know, but go ahead, Christine, sorry.
No, I was just going to say, when he's asked directly, he tends to say something like, oh, it's a big and confusing number. I'm not going to get into the details.
It's a big number, we'll save money in the other way because we're not going to be spending it on this thing. So we're going to spend it on the other thing. My point is that it's like Make America Great Again. It's we're going to win, and we're going to win, and this is the way we're going to win.
And trust me.
Right? So, and remember, Bush won in 2000. I mean, Bush won going away, and then by saying, I'm going to do four things. I'm only talking about four things. I'm talking about education. I'm talking about this. I'm only going to do four things. I'm only talking about them. Don't throw me off. Like, this is my big picture thing. This is how I'm handling it. And Obama said, you know, change. What do you hope and change? Like, and Biden, but the reason that it's a two-man race, I would say, and why Klobuchar hasn't caught on and all of that, is that Biden also has a big message. Biden has the moral message, that implicitly moral message that Noah's talking about, which is, we're better than this. We don't have to live in this you know, we don't have to live through this moral squalor. You put me in place. I'm old and I know a lot and whatever. But, you know, I'm here to cleanse this country from this supposed nightmare. And if you want that message, he's the guy. And if you want the redemptionist, not the redemption, but if you want the future, you know, get candy message, you'll go with Bernie. The question is whether, in a fiendish way, focusing on impeachment for 3 months has done Trump's work anyway. And so he didn't get an announcement that Burisma, you know, tried to steal the 2016 election or whatever. But he has had three months of headlines about Hunter Biden, and has somehow this driven inchoately Democrats to say, well, you know what, I like Bernie better. I like Bernie's message better anyway. And
it's drawn Biden closer to Trump in the public's perception of these things.
Right.
He's now another sort of detail of this Trump story.
And by the way, if you don't think that this was weighing on Biden's mind, this is what I think. You know, he didn't, I mean, I think basically he knew he was going to run, but he didn't announce till April. And when the thing that was there that was haunting him, and we know this because they cooperated with the New Yorker piece on Hunter and Burisma, was this. He knew that he had a skeleton. He knew he had a problem. He knew he had a family problem. He knew that it was going to pull his son through the ringer. And they basically had to make a choice whether or not he was going to do that, because he either wanted to be president or he wanted to save America from Trump or whatever. But, you know, the candidacies go through this. Like, it's like, are you willing to have this terrible thing said about you, about your, you know, and remember, Bush, you know, had this thing. He had this drunk driving arrest in 1976 that was so haunting to him that, you know, if they'd gotten it out in August of 2000 instead of, you know, letting it fester until it was, you know, a late hit the last week, maybe he would have won going away. You know, I mean, Karl Rove says that he lost 4 million or 5 million votes because of the drunk driving thing. Can't keep these things under wraps. That's why they put out the Burisma story through the New Yorker, the Biden campaign. So, you know, that's the one hope for him, is that that'll seem like old news by October. And with that, we will bring this podcast to a close. Commentary, of course, the 70-odd-year-old monthly of intellectual analysis, political probity, and cultural criticism from a conservative perspective. We invite you to join us at commentarymagazine.com. You get a few free reads. We ask you to subscribe. $19.95 digital, $29.95 all access for Noah, Abe, and Christine. I'm John Podhoretz. Keep the candle burning.